for you, everybody. Welcome to the Eric Anders Lang Show. We have, I think this may be the first time, Cameron, I've ever had a guest on the pod whose pod I've also been on.
There you go. Novel.
It's a novel idea. Mm-hmm. So what we're going to do is we have Cameron McCormick here. Cameron, how do you introduce yourself to people that are curious about you in an elevator or any location for that matter?
Failed professional golfer who was forced into coaching the game to stay in the game. Husband of a beautiful wife and father of two wonderful kids of 11 years old and, well, almost 11 years old and 9 years old. Living in Dallas, Texas, an Australian kind of expat. Moved to the United States to pursue golf.
So I've asked about 100 people that question, and that may be the best answer I've ever gotten. Just succinct.
It's all correct. Downhill from here.
Are you sure you haven't served? It sounds like a military answer a little bit. But so we'll get into your story, and then we're going to take a break. And Corey's here, Corey Lundberg, who you...
business partner in Altus.
Business partner in Altus. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you guys have your own origin story of your own podcast, which we'll get into. Mm-hmm. But for now, to go right into it, I have a feeling, like I've obviously never taken a lesson from you, but you focus primarily on what in a lesson with a student?
Student needs. So they're going to stand in front of me. If I've never met them before, I'm going to try and gather as much information about them in a short period of time, about where their game's at, what they desire, what limitations they have in time, in resources, in mobility, et cetera, et cetera. And that might be 5 to 30 minutes of a conversation. Hopefully that's done in advance. But again, going back to the root question is, what are they going to get from me? They're going to get what they want as well as what they need. And sometimes those two things are miles apart, aren't they? Someone comes with an understanding of wanting to improve their game, and they think they need to hit it further, or they think they need to hit a draw versus the maybe left-right shape slice or a fade for a right-handed player. And sometimes that's true and sometimes it's not. And so there's a conversation that goes on trying to find a meeting point between or a balance between what they think they want and what they actually need to improve their game and enjoy golf more. And I think underpinning that is the understanding that I'm a skills first, style second coach, and that's the ethos at Altus is as long as we can do with the golf ball what we need to do to enjoy our game, to achieve the goal of hopefully shooting a lower score, then it really doesn't matter how it looks as long as it's functional. So function over form, skills over style.
This is not about me, but I am curious to know. It was surprising for me to hear you say other people also have this sort of, I don't know if it's an egotistical desire to prefer a draw mm-hmm. over a cut. Because I've sort of, I look at 2019 as the year where I succumbed to hitting a cut. And it's going well thus far, even though I've sacrificed a lot of pride in the mirror and a couple yards. But why? I mean, is it just because why? I don't understand.
So you ate humble pie and you're tolerating the slice, or you're tolerating the fade, is what you're talking about.
It's a cut. It's a fade.
Yeah, I'm not too sure. I think that if we go back, there's this impression and a misconception probably that the best players in the world play a draw, and quite frankly, they don't. I think if you drew all of the players on the PGA European and even the LPGA on a continuum across the board, the left side being fade and the right side being draw, you'd have just as many players on the left side as you would the right side. Now, it's the excessiveness of the curve that probably compels a recreational player, an amateur, to say, I need to change it to the opposite curve rather than just softening the amount of curve that they play.
Slice being a common...
Exactly. Right. Crop duster slice being the one that curves into the trees pretty darn quick. Versus the soft fade that you see most of the players in the PGA Tour play. And the net of it is that there's a lot of efficiencies in, better way for me to say it, a player learning to hit a draw is like pushing a rope uphill. It's really difficult. And the reason for that is the club face is coming open to the target in the downswing, right? The club face is actually probably 12 inches before the ball, still pointed some 25 degrees to the right of target. It's massively to the right, essentially. So if it's going to be open, then we may as well play with an open club face relationship and curve it from left to right. It's the easiest. It's the path of least resistance. So rather than pushing rope uphill, let's pull it uphill. You following me?
Wow.
Meta.
Well, I guess let's just
we can
just
insert a video explanation.
Well, we're about to enter the weeds, and I'm gonna go. Mm-hmm. We're going
rabbit hole. Here we go.
Gabe Hirschfeld, right? You know Gabe? Mm-mm. Gabe Golf. Anyway,
Gabe Hirsched.
Hirsched. Mm-hmm. That's his name, and so that's why you didn't know the first guy.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, love Gabe. I know him by his first name. Mm-hmm. First name basis. Gabe and I.
I was with Gabe last week.
Oh, he's such a great guy.
Yeah, he's awesome.
We ran into him at Rancho the other day. And,
as you would.
And he's such a nice guy. He's just pumped on the game.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously developed a really wonderfully interesting swing trainer with the timing.
Yep.
The Hideki.
The magnetic, yeah.
Yeah. But he was like, oh, you know, I was going through my thing too, where I'm getting stuck, I get blocked, whatever. And he was like, put the ball back in your stance and open the club face if you want to hit a draw. And I was like, that's...
Mind blown.
That's literally, I have to leave now. That's not true. That's not true. But then it was true.
Mm-hmm.
And my ball striking has improved in the past couple of weeks.
Beautiful. But now you're saying you've converted back to a draw in the last couple of weeks?
What I've done is the irons have straightened out.
Yeah.
And then I just put the ball up in my stance, close the club face, and I just swing for the fences and hit a cut off the tee with the driver.
Beautiful.
But and that's what he said is cut is put the ball forward, close the club face, or square club face at address,
mm-hmm.
and just pull across the ball.
Right.
Now, but why is everything changing all the time? Is it me or is it actual science?
I think that what you're dealing with right there, when you put the ball back, you're catching it early in the arc. Early in the arc means the club path is moving to the right of target. So that's one of the elements that you need in order to be able to play a draw. The logic behind the open club face is a greater compulsion, a greater point of attention that you need to make sure you get that club face snap closed at the bottom. So when you see an open club face at the bottom, your brain is then compelled to, holy shit, I better close this thing, otherwise it's going to go miles to the right, which then enables you to hit that draw.
Right.
The counter logic to that on the forward side of the arc, when the club's rising up, it's actually traveling further left than what it would be as it's traveling down, and so it makes it easier to hit a fade. And the reason you're going to play from what you termed it a closed club face and then revise that to square club face is so you don't feel like it's going to be the crop duster slice. So you can feel like you hit more of a bleeder fade or a squeeze fade, that if it does anything, it's not going to curve enough. It's going to kind of hang down the left side. And that's the oxymoron probably in like all reality, the power of fade. Because in reality, a draw, given the way it's striking the ball, is going to come up with more ball speed, given the same clubhead speed and the same contact location. So if you hit a draw out of the center of the face and a fade out of the center of the face with the same club delivery, same club speed, the draw is going to go further. It's going to have more ball speed at least.
Yeah. Okay, we can... So now we can...
We can shift. Let's pivot out of this.
This episode of The Swing Fix is now over. Thank you, Michael.
Thanks, Michael.
You did something interesting there. You said you reiterated what I said as far as closed and square and the it was how important is listening for you in your job?
It's the most essential skill.
And what are you listening for?
I'm listening for your ideas. I'm listening for how does your concept fit with reality?
Crazy, AKA?
Exactly. Yeah, no doubt. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Kind of, right?
You've passed that test, though. You are not crazy. at least not certifiably crazy.
Not in this interview. Yep.
As we get deeper into it, we may tangentially go to a little bit more towards crazy. But yeah, I'm listening for what your ideas are, what your needs are, what your concepts, how concrete and solid they are. And how fixed you are to them as well.
What would you say is the most interesting thing you hear when you're really... Because I can tell you're a really good listener. That's why I bring it up.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say is the most interesting thing you actually hear from people? Not even just students, but just people.
Hear or can infer. Because when you're listening for words, but you're also looking and trying to interpret the language behind them, right? The body language. You've got a BS detector that's going on inside your head as well.
So you're swing Sherlock.
Yeah, like the BS detector was going off when I was going down the rabbit hole of draw fade technique. I'm like, oh, crap, he doesn't want to go there.
You could tell. Well, it's not that I don't want to go there. It's that I know that we've got a lot of people driving to work or mm-hmm. riding a lawnmower or on a train. And, you know, I guess what I know is, too, is like if you don't want to know about the swing or you don't want to work on the swing, the last thing you want to do is listen to it or talk about it. Because then it's like you added a new ingredient to something that you thought was already good.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, moving on. Yeah. What's the most interesting thing you hear people or infer?
Mm. There's a lot of lies that people tell themselves. There's a lot of pitching a story to themselves to protect ego. That's the most interesting thing that I hear. And then getting underneath that ego to uncover the vulnerability so you can start from the same place, which is we're just trying to get better. And realize that you're a player out there recreationally and you may not hit it as far as the rest in your group, and you don't need to play from the back tees. Move forward a set of tees. You're going to enjoy the game more. That's the type of sobering reality that people need to take that dose of more often.
Time out. You are arguably top of the game swing coach, right? Swing coach is the, what do you use? What do you call it?
Coach. Golf coach.
Golf coach.
Top. Swing coach, putting coach, short game coach, mental coach, strategy coach.
Sure.
Sometimes even life coach. Yeah. Which is a scary proposition.
But you're up there. You're up there with the best of them. You've had many, many players on all tours win. Mm-hmm. You've had your own success, and you just said I might enjoy it more. But why do you care if I enjoy it more? Aren't you performance and results related?
Yeah, but performance and results is enjoyment. When you shoot a lower score, when you hit better shots, you're smiling more. I mean, the net of it is I'm just trying to put smiles on faces. And if you enjoy it more, then you're playing more golf. If you're playing more golf, you're buying more Titleist golf balls. If you're buying more Titleist golf balls, Titleist might even pay me more.
Swipe up for Cameron's logoed ball. That's great that you play Vice balls. I didn't know
that.
Oh,
shit. Wind back 15 seconds. Edit. Delete.
No, this is an unedited podcast. I like all golf brands, you know, because they support all my friends. Mm-hmm. And that's cool that we all have a, you know, family to feed with these businesses. But don't ever say that. No, I'm kidding. That's interesting, man. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the sandbelt.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the sandbelt. What is that? How does that make you feel when you think about the sandbelt?
Makes the hair stand up at the back of my neck.
In a good way.
How many of your listeners do you think know what the sandbelt is?
Oh, I would say 30%.
Okay. And for the 70% that don't, it is golf mecca. In a very, very condensed era, you have the most pristine, the best designed golf courses in the world from 100 years ago. Alistair McKenzie's just out the wazoo. Royal Melbourne, Kingston Heath, Metropolitan, Huntingdale, Victoria, and the list goes on. It just doesn't stop. And so you can, for pennies on the dollar, comparative to playing, let's say, in United States, anywhere where you can get on daily fees, you can go and play some of the best places in the world, in the arguably the best sporting city in the world, Melbourne, where weather's kind of like San Francisco, gets cool, but it also gets warm, cool nights, hot days. And the grass conditions are always just real tight, firm, and fast. Yeah, it makes the hair stand up on the back of my neck. And as a young player, now I started in the game late, 15, 16 years old, and I wasn't a member of a sandbelt club, but that's what you had in your mind as the my piece de resistance. And I was with a buddy, and we would go sneak on. And we played Royal Melbourne, and we'd kind of cut the first hole out. We'd start on the second hole, and we make ourselves members of some of the best clubs in Australia. And when I go back, people want me to disclose the identity of the person that I did that with. And I'm sworn to secrecy at the number of times I was able to sneak on without being found out.
Are we talking like 12 or like 100?
Probably closer to 25, 30 times.
That's a lot.
That is a lot.
That's
yes.
more times than probably most Royal Melbourne members played in that year.
Yeah, I agree.
So, Gil Hance calls it a fence membership.
In what way?
Because he grew up around Marion, okay. And he would jump the fence and play Marion.
There you go.
And he called himself a fence member, meaning he was a member once he was able to climb the fence. Or
love it. I mean, I'm surprised they didn't even give me a locker at the end of the day.
Might have locked you up. I've only snuck onto one course.
Which is that?
Cyprus.
Mm.
But Corey just Dayton looked up. but that's another story. So was it terrifying to sneak onto Royal Melbourne? Because I mean, Royal Melbourne is not just a great golf course. It's sort of the business and political head of the golf courses in Melbourne. Am I correct?
I mean, that's a fair statement. Yeah, and it wasn't a scary prospect other than you're doing something you know that's against the law, against the rules, you're trespassing. But I think the reality was if we get caught, we just get asked to, they just asked us to leave, right? So we weren't in any way thinking about it like, oh, the what-if scenario. We weren't troubleshooting. We weren't problem setting in our heads in advance. We were like, we're going to go play Royal Melbourne. We're going to go play it today. And that was this thing. We jumped in the car and we're like, where are we going to sneak on today?
Gangster.
It was an adventure. It was an adventure in golf.
Ding! You, I mean, because Royal Melbourne has this pretty formidable entrance. Like, there's like a mile-long driveway.
Mm-hmm. Hedgerows.
Hedges are like 20 feet tall. Mm-hmm. And I remember, I'm not uncomfortable. It's hard for me to find myself in an uncomfortable situation. Well, I mean, that's not entirely true. I mean, I guess, how do I say this? Anyway, Royal Melbourne made me, relatively speaking, over most golf courses that I enter into, I was like, whoa, this is a big deal. Mm-hmm. Even though when we played, it was totally casual and I had a really great time. But anyway, so you did that, and then you said you got started in competitive golf a little late.
Mm-hmm. 16 years old, and the guys that were I was trying to compete against that had been well-developed to that point were Robert Allenby and Stuart Appleby.
I love Stuart. We just played with him at Isleworth the other day.
There you go. Great guy. And then right behind those guys was Aaron Baddeley and Jeff Ogilvie. And so those were the four that you were kind of looking up to. Stephen Allen included, probably a little bit older than those other two. Those are the guys you look up to and you were chasing. And so I was starting a race from miles and miles behind in this marathon of developing your skills as a youth player. And the only way I could catch up, or at least potentially catch up, was to spend every waking hour absorbed and kind of infused into trying to develop my skills and playing as much golf as I could. And that meant I needed a longer time horizon to try and get to the level where they were at, which they were all turning pro out of amateur golf at 17, 18 years old. I mean, Bads won an Australian Open at 17 years old, beating Greg Norman, and I think Colin Montgomery might have been in that final group as well. Mm-hmm. So being exceptional at 16, 17, 18 years old as they were, I had to come to college to give myself a little bit more runway to develop. And the net of it is I didn't really get all that good after all.
Well, I mean, I believe it all works out.
Yeah.
For a reason. You talked about that phase of your life. Obviously, it's different for a lot of people, but I think most golfers experience it in some way, which is that kind of puzzled, puzzle-solving, obsessed phase of golf where, you know, like for amateurs who aren't have any idea of going pro, they're just trying to sort of hit the center of the club or whatever, but you know, I've been interfacing with some new golfers recently, and it's been so interesting to hear them sort of after a few months say something like, "I want to be a scratch golfer," and I just love that.
Yeah,
and I just love that, like, that's invariably going to be your experience when the golf bug hits. The symptom is sort of delusions of grandeur, but not even really delusions, but just this like, I'm going to drop everything in my life, even though I have no way of making money off of this hobby. But I just want to, you know, master it or whatever, be consistent. Or I just want to get as close to the game as I can.
Yeah.
And that's the golf bug really is a marvelous time of fertility in our lives. I'm sure that you'll have a great way of contextualizing this in all of your experience with you know, the thousands of people you've met in golf. Do you see it as being a special time? And why do you think it is so major when you're in it?
I think that the opportunity to go out and play and hit really great shots exists for anyone, whether it's a 36 handicap or a zero handicap. And that's the allure, that's the hook, that you can experience the same feeling, the same quality of contact, the same flight, and the same accuracy, right? I've never had a hole-in-one in my life and probably played...
Whoa.
Exactly. Yeah, we can unpack that later. I've hit a lot of great shots in my life. Come on, I've shot 65 on umpteen occasions, but nonetheless, never had a hole-in-one.
You and I are going to do a hole-in-one challenge.
There you go. We can do that later. Yeah, that'll be an afternoon activity. But yeah, people can hit great shots like they see on TV, and that's the hook. And if you can do it once, then the thought in your mind, the aspirational side of you kicks in, you're like, I can do it again. And I think that it doesn't take much to trigger and spark that aspiration, which is why golf can be so immediately addictive, and why people think that they can go from recreational player of maybe 20, 15, 10, and think that they can drop 3 or 4 strokes off in a week or 2 weeks or a month of action. The challenge becomes when you deal a dose of reality there, that they're trying to do something that they've never done before, akin to driving from here maybe to Miami and not having a map, right? Not having a GPS unit. They're trying to navigate to a place that they're just kind of feeling themselves out, kind of like driving in the dark, yeah?
Is that a positive or a negative thing?
It's a negative. It's a negative because it's a very easy thing for them to get off track and not know whether, number one, they're heading south from Orlando to Miami, and number two, not knowing whether they're on the right road and really not knowing the speed that they're traveling at. And that's where what I do and what Corey does and all of us collectively at Altus, or even all of those that call themselves instructors or coaches, are charged with. We're charged with being the navigator, being the GPS unit that gives them that position, direction, and velocity statement. Okay, here's where you're at, here's where you need to get to, and here's the speed you need to be practicing at to make sure that you drop the two or three shots. But going back to the root question, it's easy to find the aspirational side of your, I guess, character or identity because of the opportunity to be really successful with one shot in a round of golf. I mean, going back to my junior days, I remember it really well. I remember holing out a particular shot on a par four at Eastern Golf Club that's no longer existing in Doncaster, Victoria, and that being the reason very early on, maybe in my first two or three weeks of really being invested in golf, coming back and putting more time into it. I thought, oh yeah, I can be a pro just based on holing out a shot on a par four with a pitching wedge. I mean, how ludicrous is that? That one shot gave me this identity, this ideal to say, okay, that's the mountain I'm going to climb. It's silly.
That's a common meme, you know, when you when you have two good shots in a row, then you Google, how do I turn professional? That's actually one of my favorites. And it always makes me laugh.
Coming from your own experience.
Yeah. I should have deleted that video. How do you think of your mentors? Who can you talk about where you were inspired or who taught you the most?
Mm-hmm. My dad, first and foremost, the most amazing work ethic to a fault. And I inherited that from him to a fault. But yet again, that's really largely why I'm able to do what I do with some of the best players in the world, because I've turned over umpteen thousands of stones to try and gather all the information I could, so I'm able to help them immediately and with efficiency. So the solutions I give them are hopefully the right solution, and hopefully they work immediately. And that comes from this underpinning of the principle of, I'm just going to read and research and watch and learn as much as I possibly can. So my dad's the primary inspiration. And the second inspiration is the game itself, the difficulties, but also the pleasures that come from it. And then after that, it would be the clients that I get to spend time with, that they inspire me to do better for them. But at the same time, they also give me a sense of pride and accomplishment when they accomplish their goals, whether that's winning club championship, whether that's success in the Pig Wolf game, or whether that's success on the world stage. All of those things give me that same sense of pride that I'm on the right track. There have been many people along the way that I would call coaches, the sage that you can sit at the feet at and learn from. But to do justice to all of them would be to, how do I say it? Not do justice to some.
You can't name them all.
I can't name them all. Yeah.
So I'll name one.
Go.
Coach Wooden.
Oh, massive, massive influence, but never met him. But by extension through his books and through an associate of ours who's a researcher on coaching expertise, Wade Gilbert, I feel like we have learned a lot about his pyramid of coaching and who he was.
Can you explain a little bit about that? I have a feeling there's a handful of people who don't. I feel like there's a handful of people who might not know his career and kind of how he felt. I think one of the most interesting things that I've learned is he was not really interested in winning or score, but as a successful coach, he was interested in other things that transcended sport. And I have a feeling that might be what inspired you. Can you just sort of tell a little story about him or something?
Yeah, as best I can. And you can fact check.
It's all true.
All you want.
It's
exactly, all true. Yeah. I mean, if it comes out of my mouth, it has to be true, yeah. Right? that's a primary misconception that I hold, but nonetheless, Coach Wooden measured success, or I think that anyone who adopts that ethos of philosophy measures success not based on the win-loss column, not based on the score at the end of the game, but based on those things that aggregate to your best performance on any given day. And it was fundamentally observed in things that you did in practice. But even before you got to practice, or even before you stepped on the court, or insert other sport, the field of play, it was dotting I's and crossing T's. It was making sure your shoelaces were tied. It was making sure that your socks were worn or pulled up the right way. And those are very surface examples, but they resonate and they hit the point of do the little things well, and it aggregates to doing the big thing well. The big picture is only a massive jigsaw puzzle, and all the pieces need to fit together in order for your best performance to come. And at the same time, he was a coach to athletes, but more importantly than that, he was a coach to people. And the people that he had contact with, his reach extended beyond the court, beyond the practice arena. It bled into the greater community of coaches and athletes that never met him, and I'm included in that. And that's the influence that I think if he could reflect now from the grave, he would say he was most proud of, that there was this ripple effect, like you drop the pebble into the water and yes, you see the immediate result of the splash, but then the those ripples last for an extended period of time until they hit the shore, and then they're reverberating back off the shore as well. And that's probably the most compelling thing that it's one of the goal orientations that I have as well, is that you can extend influence beyond face-to-face contact, is you can extend influence at the PGA show, let's say, to peers that look up to you for advice, respect, and guidance. And it can last for a long time. It lasts because they take it with them, and they go back to the players they coach at their own club, and they say, I learned this from someone, and I'm a better coach for it. Or maybe you don't even get credit for it, and you don't need credit for it, but you know that they're doing a better job because of the one conversation or the one presentation you gave or the one question that you answered for them. And that's what Coach Wooden is to me, and I think he is to most people that embrace and value what they can learn from him.
Okay, and then, you know, how old are you when you're... Where is the place where you meet Jordan Spieth? Where are you?
He's
12, you're late 20s?
I can't remember. I don't do math really well, but it's 2006. I remember that. Born in 1973, so quick math, go.
27. Perfect. What did you say? What year?
2006. July.
Okay, 33.
Of 2006. And I'm 6-7 years into my coaching career, and I've had some success to that point. And I'm at Brook Hollow Golf Club, Tillinghast Course in Dallas, Texas. And I get a call from Jordan's dad, and he says, I've got a kid who's pretty good at golf. Would you be interested in taking a look? And I said, of course. And we talk about his performance at that point, and he hadn't had much professional coaching, or none at all, quite frankly. And I meet him 2 weeks after that. And as part of that process of understanding who that person is, you sit down and you ask them questions. And the first question I said is, well, basically, why are you here? What do you want in golf? And how can I help you get that? He's like, I want to win the Masters. I paused. Oh. Like, you kidding me? 12 years old, just shy of his 13th birthday. And I said, okay, great. We can head in that direction, no problem. But tell me more about your golf game. And the story goes on. We talk for 30 minutes, and he says that my level of golf right now is pretty good. And I said, yeah, I did some research on you. I looked at the scores that you post on in the recent tournaments, but your dad said that there was a tournament you were playing. This is in the phone conversation 2 weeks prior to our first meeting, and I couldn't find those scores. Can you tell me about it? He said, yeah, I won the last tournament. And I said, well, congratulations. And he follows with nothing. And I said, well, tell me about the performance, because our starting point in getting you somewhere is knowing more about your golf game, your skills. And so there's a level of humility, even at 12 years old, to not want to tell me that he shot 63 in the final round in this junior golf event, regional golf event, and won the tournament by 18 shots. 63. And that was my second, are you kidding me, Jordan Spieth moment, the first being when he sat down in front of me and said, Cam, I want to win the Masters.
It came in pretty quick succession.
Exactly, yeah, quick succession. And then I said, cool, let's take a look at your skills. And he's a pretty good ball striker, decent putter, decent short game. But he came with a really funky, idiosyncratic movement, something that was organic. It was just learned through his own experience, trial and error. And it was beautiful. It was beautiful because of what he could do with the ball. And so I turned off all the equipment, that the fancy equipment that you would to run diagnostics, the video, the TrackMan, Sam Putlab. And I said, let's go play. I want to see this on the golf course. Almost in my mind calling bullshit on what this kid had. Because to that point, I'd had experience with some really decent players, some actually really good players, a player that won on a web.com tour, multiple different professional players. But I'd never seen that level of skill show up with someone that young and with someone that has that much confidence in the work that what they're doing. I didn't want to get in the way of that. So we go to the golf course and we play 9 holes, and invariably he shows me the set of skills that he demonstrated in session, that he demonstrated in that previous event when he shot 63 and won by 18 shots. And finishing up that story, we're on the final hole, and it was hitting every fairway and every green and two putting along the way. And I wasn't seeing any short game skills, so I gave him a challenge. I said, the last three holes of this nine holes we'll play, I'm going to lay down three up and down opportunities for you, three short game shots. And you're going to pitch, chipper, hit him out of the sand.
Sorry, timeout.
Yep.
You just called it an up and down opportunity. Is that a thing?
Yeah, that's a thing. So miss a green, up is the shot onto the green, and the down is the putt into the hole.
No, I know what up and down is, but you called it an opportunity.
Opportunity.
Well, a lot of people would call it a problem. I'm serious.
Yeah, I guess.
So that's just innately your mind? That's the way you see it?
I think so, yeah.
That's not like a rule of working with Cameron?
No, not at all.
Interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So anyway, you put down the three balls.
Back to the
opportunities.
Yeah, so he's four over par through the first six opportunities. So the first hole we play three, he makes two bogeys, plays him three, and makes one par. The next hole, he does the same thing. We get to the final hole, and I've set a reward for him as well. I said, if you play these in three over par or less, I'm going to buy you a hat from the Broccolo Golf Shop. And Broccolo, Tillinghast Course, 1920, it's like held in high esteem in his mind. He's never been here before. It's a pretty immaculate place, particularly coming from where he grew up, which is a public, semi-private facility of 54 holes, Brookhaven. And he's behind the eight ball, and I'm not seeing a short game skill set that he described in our interview session. And I want to take it easy on him because I don't want to knock his ego down. I don't want to influence his identity in any direction, right? I still want this kid to have confidence leaving the session. And I give him a pretty simple up and down this next one from just off the fringe, about a 25, 35-foot chip and run, and he chips it in. So he goes from four over par to three over par. And he's right on the win threshold, right? He has to play nine opportunities in three over par or less. And the next one, I put him in a bunker, and he hits this sick little spinning bunker shot that I hadn't seen from a 12-year-old to that point, and taps it in. And so the last hole, or the last opportunity, I make it as tough as I possibly can because I didn't know whether I'm going to see this 12-year-old again. This is the first time I'm seeing he and his dad, and I'm just evaluating him. Not too sure whether he likes it or hates it. So to give a kid a hat that I'd never seen before, that was in the back of my mind. And so I make it as tough as I can, buried in Bermuda grass, middle of summer, Dallas, Texas, short-sided, downslope about 15 feet of green to work with. And he sets,
I'm getting stressed.
Yeah, and he sets up to the shot and takes a couple of practice swings, testing out the grass, which in my mind was like, oh, Christ.
Brilliant.
This kid has a really high golf IQ to evaluate how the club's going to move through the grass, to see whether he can slide the ball under, which then informs him as to what shot he should play. He strolls on down to the edge of green, looking at where he should land the shot, and then walks back and looks at me, and he just smiles. And he sets into the shot, takes a little waggle, and hits this sick flop shot. It hits on the fringe exactly where I could anticipate he was looking at landing it, and it trickles on down and hits the hole. And I just lose my shit. And I look at the hole, I look back up, and he points at me. He says, how about that hat?
How about that hat?
12 years old.
And then a few years later, he said, how about that jacket?
Exactly, that green one, yeah.
So, wow. What a great experience.
That was my 30, are you kidding me, Jordan Spieth moment. It happened within a 2.5, 3-hour time frame of meeting the kid.
I think we all met Jordan Spieth at the John Deere. Where were you then?
Met him at the John Deere in what way?
We all in
at the victory?
In as golf fans. Right, when he chipped in, and I believe that was the first playoff hole, or maybe it was the final hole regulation. I can't quite remember, but...
Yeah, so he pitched in out of the bunker to get into the playoff.
Yes, he went.
Yeah, I was driving home from lessons. I knew what was happening, and I wanted to get home and watch it with my family at the chance that he would win. I wanted to share it with those people that had supported me through the working, 70 hours a week. Through not seeing dad because he's out there coaching, or not seeing husband because he's out there coaching. And I could have stayed at the club. Everyone at the club was watching it. This is Broccolo in the golf shop. I saw the crowd gathering and I knew what was happening, but I booked it home. So 15 minutes I missed. I saw the hole out bunker shot at the club, and then I drove home knowing it was a playoff and knowing that he had to wait for the final group to finish. And then I watched those holes at home. And I still have the 7-iron that he used from the right trees in that final hole of John Deere, mm-hmm. whatever playoff hole that was, maybe the second or third playoff hole. And it's a memento that he gave me to commemorate that first victory. That 7-iron, he pitched under the trees and rolled to the back of the green and two-putted for that first victory.
that was pretty much, at that point, the curtain was drawn and the world was introduced to him. At least, you know, the larger percentage of golf fans. I think it's
fair, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then pretty much, did anything change at that point? Or was it really just status quo as far as his attitude and your sort of syllabus?
Yeah, it's an insightful question. And it's the amazing thing about Jordan, his brother, his sister, and the collective of family, is that at many points in time, maybe I anticipated, or maybe I expected, or maybe I thought there might be a change in our interaction, he to I and he to everyone else around him. And all the while, perspective was just, I'm just Jordan Spieth, I love golf, and I want to become the best person I can. And that's a player, but also it's the best person he can. And so what you see come across in interviews, in every maybe exposure to knowing more about him, it's authentic. It's not a facade, and it never has been. I remember back to finishing 16th in his first professional event, playing as an amateur, the PGA Tour event, Byron Nelson. And I anticipated that would have been the biggest opportunity for him to get a big head and walk around like he's on cloud nine, and for him to expect that everyone around him should worship him. And it wasn't that. And that comes back to family. Shine that light directly back to mom and dad. Shine that light to the extended family, grandma, grandpa, et cetera, et cetera. And that gave me an interesting perspective in how to manage, I guess, development of son and daughter, that hopefully I've learned in implementing those lessons.
Fantastic. Okay, we'll take a quick break. Be right back. All right, folks, you know my favorite golf shoe, don't you? I think you do. It's Three Stripe Life, y'all, and that means Adidas. And so anyway, I just wanted to tell you that when I'm a big fan of the Tour 360, obviously, and they've made a huge update to the Tour 360, and the two letters that it's concerned with are the letters X and T, okay? The Tour 360 XT changes the game, okay? It's lighter, so your feet feel even better after a round. By the way, a light golf shoe is what I'm all about. A heavy, there are some other companies making heavy golf shoes, and I'm just like, by the way, I weigh enough. There's enough going on. I'm carrying a golf bag. I'm carrying my team. Tour XT changes the game. It's lighter, so your feet feel even better after a round, and it still features that Boost, y'all. Do you know where Boost comes from? And Boost is cool because it only comes in black and white. I don't know if you noticed that. And actually, the guy who made Boost like was going to bring it to some other, you know, they were shopping it around, and everyone else said no. Adidas was like, I'll take that Boost, even though it's only black and white. And what did Adidas do with it? They made it awesome. I'm looking at Boost right now on my feet. Boost on my feet. And it has an X-shaped traction system that gives you insane stability. Literally, it's not sane. It's literally crazy. Your feet will literally be like, I'm crazy. Best part, it comes in spikeless. Ooh, that's tight. The first spikeless ever in the history of the Tour 360. Crazy comfortable and perfect for the course. Get your pair at adidas.com. Thank me later. Follow Adidas Golf for all the latest and greatest. That's all true statements right there. Check it out. Go support Adidas because they're a good company, good people. I like it. All right, we're back, everybody, and now we have a third. Corey has joined us. Corey Lundberg, yeah. Can you? We were making a joke as the commercials were airing that Cameron was saying, "I just can't wait to hear how Corey introduces himself." So we're all surprised, yeah. And my parents also listening want to know who right. Corey Lundberg is. Let's hear.
Well, I guess for this context right here, I mean, I'm Cameron's business partner with Altus, and I'm a golf coach. And yeah, you said that he gave the best explanation that you ever heard. So anything that I say right now is going to fall short of that. So just leave it at that. I'll be simple. I'm not going to try to.
You're the first person to speak on the Earn Your Edge podcast that you guys do together.
Usually, typically.
You yeah. introduce it.
Yeah.
How did that come about? That's forward facing is aside from people who are lucky enough to visit you guys at Altus or lucky enough to work with you around the world. You guys have a podcast. Can you explain which I was on, which you yeah. should check out. And yes. I was actually wondering, actually, you know, what'd be cool is, I don't know why I cut. I cut yeah. to talk about
it. Yeah,
I
didn't keep this raw.
I didn't want to put you guys on the spot, gotcha. But I cut and basically asked Cameron and Corey if they'd be okay if I took their recording of the podcast that we did for yours, Earn Your Edge, which, by the way, I posted it, and people hit me up, and they're like, that is the best podcast you've ever done. And I was like, thanks. But it was really good. It was, you guys are great interviewers.
Thank
and
you.
I was
Thank
like,
you.
I felt, you know, like, I realized that maybe I felt very taken care of, you know what I mean? Like, in a nice. Sense of, like, you guys were, like, you knew what you wanted. And I realized that maybe people feel very terrified when they sit down to a podcast yeah. with me because it could go anywhere.
Well, yeah. I like that.
Okay, good. All right.
Yeah.
Terrifying is good. Yeah. But anyway, talk about Earn Your Edge and tell me a little about that and how you guys collaborate on
yeah,
that.
Yeah. So I'll start with just kind of the origin and the reason why we started in the first place. Like 2016, well, really 2015, 2016, but especially there felt like there was a time in 2017 where the players that we coach, our clients, were achieving what felt like at the time an unsustainable amount of success, like LPGA, European Tour, PGA Tour, and then even the juniors.
They're just too good.
Well, no, I mean, it's just like we look around, like we're pinching ourselves. Like everyone is playing really, really good right now.
Can you drop some names, please?
Well, I mean, Jordan would have been a good example. There was a time where like junior golf, like there was a time there's a ranking. I think there was a time that
seven of the top 20 yeah. in the country. I think of those seven, six of them were inside the top 10 yeah. in the country. That's the junior rankings. That same year, Jordan won the Open Championship. Soyeon won the ANA. Anna Nordqvist won Evian. IK Kim won the Ricoh Women's British Open. Yeah. There was another victory from a client on the web.com tour and multiple. Cole Hammer won an event, an amateur event that year, et cetera, et cetera. It was
unreal. Yeah. It was a long list. And mm-hmm. so in that moment as coaches, you know, we're taking a pause and saying, all right, what's going on right here? Like what's in the water? Like if we're doing something different, we need to capture this so that we can continue this. And so we set up a time I think it was like at the end of 2017 mm-hmm. where we just set up interviews. So this wasn't a podcast. We just sat down with a few players and we kind of had a list of questions that we were trying to collect data on to see if,
essentially running a postmortem on yeah, how does these right. things happen.
Interesting. Yeah. It was like your own press conference kind of.
Well, yeah. And so, but we did it for us internally to see if we could learn anything. And then we were having these conversations and a lot of common threads kept like, it was spooky
really?
Sometimes like how, like almost verbatim players would say like the same thing someone else had said. And so, you know, to us, we're like, well, shit, that we might be onto something. We should share this with like everybody. And so that was the reason why we were like, let's try to turn some of these conversations we even used some of the ones where that weren't for us internally as episodes.
And that's why you have this separate introduction where you're like,
that's I'm exactly Corlander, right.
Welcome to the Earn Your Edge. Ah, yeah, that, I see.
And then that became the format. And then, so that's what we continue to do.
It's really great. You guys are you have a great interview style and you have great subjects and you're obviously, you know, the familiarity helps, but you know, you guys have a very probably a tribute to what makes you great at helping people succeed on the course is probably there's some similar potion there which helps you it's a good listening ability, I guess, is to host a good podcast.
Yeah, cool.
You have to be good at asking questions, definitely. And you're the master of asking questions. You would be a good coach if you wanted to turn your attention.
That's nice of you.
We'll
you.
Actually hire you. I'm on the air offering you a job right now.
to coach people. I don't know what I could coach them into. I think I would give them bad habits on the course. I'd be like, throw away your scorecard. Grab your 7-iron. Let's go play a few holes.
So far, great advice. Throw away the scorecard. That's great advice. It's the most immediate way to increase enjoyment.
Well, that's what he said. This wonderful guy, Max, who's just started playing golf 8 months ago, you know, he said at lunch after 18, he said, I want to be a scratch golfer. And I said, great. Do you think that'll help you enjoy the game more? And he just sort of, he had a snarky answer, but it is a curiosity. Like, how do you guys see that? I mean, you guys mostly interface with the highest level. Do you see score having an effect on them, or are they just versed in the ups and downs of it all?
Yeah, because they've got a lot of riding on it. So, I mean, they have a lot invested. And so it's inherent in that is they need to perform really, really well. But yeah, it's like managing or balancing enjoyment and performance. Like they're tied together. They're not separate. And part of our job is to push them towards, you know, positive experiences, positive outcomes. And so, you know, and when we're training players, you know, we have to balance balance that challenge point, like what Cameron's story before of making sure that he didn't pick a shot that was too difficult for Jordan in that first session so that he protects that self-image. Because if our self-image is damaged, then we're not having a whole lot of fun. And so I think it can kind of be dialed into like challenge point. Mm-hmm. It's like and making sure that no matter who we're coaching, whether it be an aspirational young player or a competitive player, elite competitive players, that we're managing the challenge point that they've got, if that makes sense, like how difficult things are for them, so that there's this good balance of I'm not so overwhelmed by this task, by what you're asking me to do, that it's that I feel like I can't do it, but also like I'm aroused. I have challenge right here. Like I'm kind of into what you're asking me to do. So, I mean, it's kind of trying to meet that point.
Right. And where did the name Altus come from? What does it mean?
It's a Latin word.
There's a bunch of really shitty names that we came up with. Altus.
You're
really
like, we were going to call it
better
response Google. We were going to call it Yahoo.
Yeah, it's been butchered on Golf Channel 2 weeks in a row. So if anybody's listening,
what do they call it on golf?
Atlas.
Yeah, they called me Corey Lindberg from Atlas Performance, and they said, because Marty Doe, one of Cameron's clients, won last week, and then they had one of my clients mic'd up this week. So, Altus.
It's nice to get the airtime, but it's also nice for the pronunciation of both a person's name and also the organization, Altus.
Yeah, that would be
good.
Craig Perks, if you're listening, we appreciate the the shout out, but let's refine that.
You mean Craig Sparks?
Craig Perks. Well played. Yes.
He's great.
So the real answer is it's a Latin word that means higher, grow higher.
Oh, like it. Mm-hmm. I like it. And you guys basically, when did the idea for that start?
Yeah.
You want to go back to how we came to...
Go for it.
Because, I mean, a lot of people would just be satisfied with, like, you know, your individual careers.
Yeah, sure. So I'm working at Brook Hollow. I've been at Brook Hollow 12, 13 years, and an opportunity comes about to move to something greater, to grow beyond my own, I guess, influence. So I can 158 hours in the week, and I can only see so many people in a week or a year. And then when this opportunity came about, I wanted to bring other people on board. I feel like what I do is unique only in the sense that I've built a body of knowledge that allows me to coach well, but it can be codified. Meaning you can teach someone to do what I do. It's not a unique skill set, can be learned. If you want to term it as a set of coaching superpowers can be learned, it's just not innate, unattainable to mere mortals. And in so doing, for me to grow, I didn't want to brand it my name. And the reason for that is it needs to exist as an identity beyond one person. Otherwise, it's seen as one person's IP, and it's really not. It's a collective of wisdom and idea and efforts and achievement from many. And so then became the pursuit of what's it going to be called. But even before that was a conversation, because Corey and I's relationship goes back 10 years pre-Altus, and it was, we're at the PGA show. Well, actually, even before that, when we saw each other at the PGA show, he reminded me that we actually played golf when I was a young assistant. Mm-hmm. He was working the bagger at Preston Trail or Castle Hills?
That was probably Castle Hills, yeah. It was a very memorable experience for
you. Yeah, not for me, but for you it was. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yep. I think there's some other experiences that you can reflect back on in college that were similar to that.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. But nonetheless, I digress. Getting back to our relationship, we knew each other for many years before. We had similar, I guess, interests in education. And we'd always see each other at these events and talk and chat about where you headed in your career, where am I headed in my career. And then ultimately, that was the spring from which came, hey, let's join forces.
Right.
And at the same time, I joined forces with another person in Dallas, Andrew Lewis. And Andrew's running our facility at Old American, which is just north of Dallas in the colony. And then Corey and I are down at Trinity Forest. And most recently, as recently as September of last year, we opened with Guillaume Bigeot at La Vaudrey, which is about an hour north of Paris. So we've got a facility in France now.
That's exciting. Yeah, mm-hmm. I saw that. The Instagram Atlas Europe.
Craig Sparks.
Yeah. There you go.
Yeah.
Dang, it just sort of gets in there and you can't get it out. Uh-huh. Can't get it out.
It's going to be a rebranding here in about a week.
I've done that. Mm-hmm. But actually, you know, you guys talk about how you met, and it sounds kind of funny we, you know, my team, right? We've all sort of met in these funny ways, right? Mm-hmm. And you know, it sort of generated this idea for us of what we jokingly refer to, but also quite seriously, of this random golf club. And the idea I feel like you guys would probably have an interesting take on is that you sort of, you know, I don't even know if I totally understand it, to be honest with you, but the idea seems to be that golf is really this place where, you know, it's like a Ouija board. You know, you kind of go out there and you just say, this is what I want. And then you basically come back into the clubhouse as if you were panning for gold. And you're like, well, this is what I got. Mm-hmm. And then you go out the next day and you're like, okay, this is what I want. And then you come back with what you got. And at some point down the line, they sort of merge together based on, I don't know what factors, but it seems like you guys have probably done that for a couple of days. And as well, the idea is how you connect to people along the way. I mean, that's a super open-ended question.
I'm not sure.
I don't know if it's a question.
Which means you can run with it any direction you want. Yeah. Corey, go.
Yeah, no, I need more. We need to dig in more to that question because I don't think I follow.
What I'm saying is the wonderfully, I don't know if I have a question. I guess I'm just saying, you know, the way you guys met, yeah. If you could trace it back to that, was that the moment that Altus started, or if do you ever go back and try to unravel the yarn?
Yeah.
And then you're like, well, how did it even start? Like,
I pinch myself when I think, God, I'm so glad that it did happen this way. You know, for me going back 10 years, you know, Cameron and I were, we were traveling on the same journey on the same road, but he was just further ahead on, you know, both years experience and what he had accomplished. And so very much like a big brother that I kind of looked to him as. And so, yeah, going back to however many years that was ago, I don't know about unraveling that, but just being, you know, I think what you're speaking, I'm going to try to interpret it. I think what you're speaking to is just kind of the serendipity of these kind of relationships that you form along the way. And then you kind of connect to people who kind of speak a similar language, who see the world the same way, who are aligned philosophically. And yeah, golf gives us that opportunity to do that a lot. I don't know if that's conjecture on what your point was or where you were going, but that's how I interpret it.
I love conjecture.
Okay, cool. Good.
I guess I don't know. It was we're moving on. Corey, what do you find most difficult about what you guys are trying to do?
Like from growing Altus or from just the coaching from like being with a client?
I think coaching. I think the one-to-one kind of interpersonal situation.
Yeah. So there's a really difficult part is the inevitable blips on that kind of road to mastery, that there's a downturn in performance and managing it, because it's inevitable. What the players that we're with, what they're doing is really, really difficult to do. They're playing for high stakes and no one is exempt from the variability that comes. And so helping players not only with their physical skills manage that variability that comes, but also mentally, like how do you handle those ups and downs and how do you fight through it? And, you know, the conversations that we have with really, really high performers that have been really, really successful, how they handle the challenges that come is often like the biggest separator. So the same event can happen to two different people. One reacts in a way that's really productive and empowering, and so they're better for it. And then some people don't react that way. And so that's the hardest part, is just getting people to helping them along that road when they respond to when shit hits the fan and it's tough and it's hard. And yeah, that's a difficult part sometimes.
Is there a technique that you use to try to teach people or try to help people to work through that in a positive way?
Yeah. So, I mean, like we'll talk like the micro sense, like not like macro, that's just like our philosophy and coaching and how we have conversations and help people. But like on a micro sense, like in a round of golf, for sure. Like when shit hits the fan in the round of golf where something bad goes on, it's really difficult to, in that spot, when you've got emotion tied to whatever happened, to come up with something that's going to get you out of it, something that's helpful, you know? And so we always try to preload that to where our players have a blueprint, and we call it the shit hits the fan plan, to where they've got...
I know that plan.
Yeah, right, exactly. So they've got like three affirmations. So
really?
Rather than try to, like, when you're like breaking clubs pissed off,
yeah,
like you're not going to come up with like the wisdom that you need to get you out of it to turn stuff around. And so, yeah, we got affirmations that it could be written on a yardage book. It could be some things that you go to that says, all right, I'm going to collect myself here and I'm going to kind of move out of whatever. And if that doesn't work, we really want our players to understand when they're playing their best golf, what does it look like physically? Like, so if I'm watching Eric play golf, when he's on his A game, like, what does he look like? Like, what is the pace that he has? Like, does he have his head high? Is he talking a lot? Like, physically, what are those characteristics? And having our players understand, like, what does it look like when you play really good? And then no matter what happens, try to embody that. It's almost like you're getting into character and you don't want to break out of that character. And so that can be a helpful piece. And then what are the mental characteristics? What are you thinking in your mind when you are playing your best? And so if you can have that stuff like as a blueprint preloaded, it's a hell of a lot more easy to access than when you're pissed off and you're breaking clubs and throwing stuff. So
that is so, I've never thought of the second one, the, what does it look like when you're playing your best golf? Like,
yeah, it came out of like us asking ourselves that question as coaches, like, because I've coached enough around Cameron where I'll see Cameron, like, I know when he's like coaching well. I can just see it. Like, I can just see the way that he moves, like the energy that I have, like I'll know when he's. And so it's like, what does it look like when you're doing this really, really well? I mean, I think you can do that for any performance, anything that anyone's doing.
Yeah. It reminds me a little bit of Deepak Chopra talks about, you know, he describes like as one of his ways of playing good golf mentally is to observe yourself playing golf.
Right.
He doesn't say observe yourself playing golf at a high level or at your best ability, but he says, you know, just sort of from right behind yourself, like 6 feet up
third
and
person.
Back, third person observing.
Yeah, cool.
I've never thought about including the like, and I'm good at golf right now.
Right.
What you talked about that made me think of. Do you guys? You watch a lot of golf, I'm sure, both live and on TV or whatever. Do you have a favorite walk of a golfer? Like, you know, every golfer walks differently. Do you have one that you like more than others?
I like Rory a lot.
What do you like about
bouncy.
It?
Bouncy. So here's the deal. So we've asked so many players that question of, like, really good players, the question of what does it look like when you play your best golf? Like, how are you walking? And so many of them say, kind of like Rory.
Really?
Like, that's a really common answer that I hear. Just because it's kind of the chest out, heads up.
Yeah.
It's got a little bit of bounce to it. It like looks really confident. And so people, really good players, like PGA Tour players, European Tour players, they cite Rory as like, yeah, that would be kind of be my model.
Does Rory know this?
No, I don't.
We got to let him know.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think Rory, by the way he walks, Rory knows it.
We could. I think Rory, you're right. Yeah. He's got big walk energy.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That's a good way to say it. Yeah.
My answer to that would be DJ.
DJ, yeah, I was thinking
that
DJ.
Slow saunter, long, languid steps. And it seems like the cadence of the walk is the cadence of his head, the thoughts in his head, which is never running too fast, kind of vibrating at a low frequency, very mellow, very chill. And I think that's a really good way to approach a lot of this. Like, you need energy, yes. And but if you're too high energy, vibrating at too high a frequency and you can recognize that, you need to slow things down, starting with your walk. And the cadence of breathing also can really help you kind of get back to a foundation of, okay, let's slow things down, let's calm things down, and then we can build back our energy level to that appropriate state. Also the walk, when you know that you've won the tournament from fairway to green with your putter in hand, that's the walk I really like.
Yeah, that's a good walk.
What did you call it? You talked about... when Jordan was had on the eve of sort of winning this little game for the hat, you called it, there was two words you used, with threshold, win threshold.
Yeah. The win threshold. Yeah.
That's a term.
Yep.
I don't know this term. Mm-hmm. I've never been there. I've been on the other side of it.
We can help you find that situation.
to go back to DJ, DJ has a thing when he walks where it looks like he's looking at a different country.
Yep.
Like he's just looking like 5,000 miles away.
Exactly. Yeah. Beautiful, isn't it?
I always, I'll be honest, like I'm, you know, I, I don't know what it was, but the first time I watched Fred Couples in person, I think it was at Riv, I was like, that's a walk.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I wasn't obviously on this, idea of, visualizing yourself, but I just remember like, it could be because of his back problems, but he just walks he's on flip flops. he's like in Weekend at Bernie's. Not a care in the world. The game has given him everything. I love that. That's so interesting. Are there any other? That's the idea of the walk is very unusual. Are there any other unusual things that you've had to sort of come up with to get your point across?
I mean, I think we're constantly trying to innovate inside of being effective as coaches, and that would be the crazy drills that we try sometimes on ourselves, most of the time on ourselves, and sometimes even on students, throwing shit against the wall and seeing if it sticks. I mean, that's the cornerstone of innovation, isn't it? Trying something and recognizing whether it's a innovative new use case for whether it's a tool or telling someone something in a different way. So countless are those, experiences. But do you have
any? That's a good point of trying to find a variety of uses for like an object. Like, again, I'll walk by Cameron's Bay and like take a double take and be like, where's that TheraBand tied to on that person right there? Like, how's he using? I've never seen that used.
Why does he have the person's hands tied behind their
back? Yeah, like, holy shit, what's he doing in there?
And are they in trouble?
Yeah, right, exactly. And so, like, as Cam says, like, the way that you innovate and come up with new ideas is, like, you can take, in coaching, we can take a training aid, use it differently than what it's meant for, a random object, and, like, just try to get as creative as we can. And so, we've come up with plenty of shitty ideas doing that, but then a handful of really good ideas that end up kind of becoming plays that we call often in coaching. Yeah.
What would you say we can wind this down in a sec, but what would you say is have you noticed a theme around where inspiration strikes you?
A theme?
Does it come, is there any sort of, what's the word? What do they call it? Helpful factors to creating innovation for you guys or new thought?
Two things that come to mind immediately when you ask that question are time. Like, if I'm given a block of time where I don't have anything pressing, then my mind goes to innovation in often cases. And then the other side of that is when I'm really pressed by a problem that's keeping me awake at night, that I'm ruminating when I go to sleep and I'm still carrying with me when I wake up, that also pushes me towards innovation. It's like high gear problem solving at that point. And those are the two kind of accelerators towards or gateways towards coming up with unique stuff.
I would say when we're reading a lot, like, which is really difficult for us to find the time, young families and busy travel schedule and coaching schedule, but when we're reading a lot, I find a lot of inspiration in that. And there's a guy named Wade Gilbert who taught us something really important about how we read to try to makes the most use out of that limited time we have, is that to kind of look for best principles and what we're reading. So rather than just look for like the best practices and just like pinch and steal from what other people are doing, like trying to read in a way other coaches kind of coach education in a way that lets us look at like, well, why does this work for someone outside of golf in another sport? What are the principles behind that? And then how can we apply that to what we do? And to me, that's where a lot of our inspiration comes from. And then like just outside of golf too, is where a lot of that inspiration comes from for us. It's cool to bring something outside of golf and back and make it our own.
Yeah. Okay. I have one more thing, but do you guys have anything you want to add? Change, delete,
no,
re-record.
No. Yeah, it's beautiful.
Okay, this is a total. This could end so badly. I don't know.
Love it. What a great way to preface.
You guys have inspired me to try something new. It's gonna be tough because I don't know how to do this with two people really.
Yeah.
Actually, you should decide who's gonna go first.
I'll let Corey go first.
Okay. All right, Corey goes first. Yeah. All right. So if you could write a letter to the game of golf, how would it go? Oh, just real briefly.
If I could write a letter to the game of golf, it would 100% be like, it'd be three kinds of letters. This is a really good question. Like a thank you letter, like appreciation, like, holy shit, look at where I am right now. Thank you so much for the fact that I started this when I was a kid, and it's given me time with my family, like bonding with my dad, now bonding with my son, gives me friendships and a job and that I love, that I wake up in the morning and makes my heart sing. Then there's a different letter that's like a I miss you letter. Like, I don't really get to play you very much anymore, and I really miss you, and I wish that I could reconnect with you sometime. So two types of letters, I think, that I would write.
Very nice.
Yeah.
And I think the gratitude would be a good starting point, and I would echo that sentiment. But on the back of the one letter that I would write would be a request looking to the future to open up and change, to take down barriers to entry. So no fences, no gates. You can have your community that you can call your club, but let's invite more people in that are good contributors to that club, to that culture. So, an openness.
We can't end now, unfortunately, because you brought up a whole... I don't know what you've got scheduled on the day, but yeah, real quickly, though, Cameron, you know, there's a lot of people listening to this who work in golf,
mm-hmm.
right? Literally, there's presidents of resorts, there's greenskeepers, there's directors of golf, there's head pros, there's assistant supers, there's caddies, there's, you know, maintenance workers, there's people in the restaurant. Like, this is the Fight Club of mm-hmm. the golf industry right here, right? Well, how do we do what you just said? How do we take down the fences? I mean, literally, because there is a binary solution
mm-hmm.
that for some reason we can't seem to outline. And so if I were to help, what would I do? Or what would a listener do?
Yeah, the first rule of Fight Club is go back to the best answer that I've heard. And when we put you on the spot on the On Your Edge podcast, you came up with a brilliant answer. And we appreciate that. And coming from looking at things through your lens, you said it starts with me. One person's actions can make a difference. And if it's the actions of a head professional or an assistant professional or a general manager at what may be known or be in reality a stuffy club, embrace that female member, that youth member when they come in and let them know that they're more welcome. When I worked in the private industry, now I'm still at a private club, but on the side of interacting with the members far more often, always at the ladies' clinics, it would be, yeah, but when I go into the golf shop or when I show up, it's like, I know the tennis space because that's the space where a lot of the ladies live, but golf is like the men's side. And am I allowed to do this? Am I allowed to do this? A little hand-holding, a little guidance along the way is really necessary. But again, first rule of Fight Club, best principle is what difference can you make as one person?
I forgot I said that. That was good.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, I mean, I think that is a big part of it. You know, it's so funny to be playing golf and you look over the other fairway at you big wave, mm-hmm. no response, and you're like, huh. I guess they don't like me. Well, and it's funny because I don't really care anymore. I used to care, but I could only imagine what it would be like to be new mm-hmm. and to experience that. That would be difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah. Big waves. Big waves to you too. Thank you for joining.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
This has been a great morning.
Yeah.
I'm excited for everyone to hear this. And we'll put all your socials down below. But basically, you know, you got what primary is Instagram, Twitter?
Instagram for sure. Instagram. At Altus Performance. And so we post a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Spelled Altus.
That's right.
Performance.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. We're also on YouTube as well. We're propagating more videos that direction as well. So
very good.
All of our plays, the stuff that we do to make a difference in players' experiences and skills are essentially given away for free. So you can have an as-like experience like you're being coached by us.
Do you think Jordan would ever just go straight to YouTube tech?
He's like, I think I'm good.
I got this.
I found this great YouTube channel. Atlas Performance, have you heard of that?
Ouch, don't close with that.
No, Altus, everybody. Thank you so much, guys. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, cheers, man.